Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
All right, well, I'm going to count you down, and let's go in 5, 4.
No, Brian counts me down.
Oh.
Don't take that away.
All right, here we go. All right, ready? 5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Oh, man, that's like next level. I didn't even have a mug to drink. I had sunflower seeds in my mouth, which is even worse. Hi.
Justin Robert.
What's up, gang? It's me, Justin Robert Young.
Gentlemen, I say we start off right now by taking a little bit of a leap.
A leap?
A magic leap, if you will.
Oh, wait a minute.
Magic.
We're talking about augmented reality magic leap, right?
We're talking about enhanced, in your face, your world is so blended you don't know what's going on magic leap, which for those of you that haven't been playing along, is a company that's got $1 gazillion worth of funding, literally $500 million worth of funding. That's not its valuation. That's how much funding they have right now from the likes of Google and other companies to make these goggles or something you put over your head. Now, this ain't Google Glass, and this ain't Oculus, or this ain't HTC Vive. This is, when you saw Microsoft HoloLens, this is supposed to be that, but like full field of view and even more realistic and et cetera, right?
Yeah.
We'll see. Nobody outside of people going to the labs actually tried this, so what they say.
Whatever that demo is the kind of demo that caused a bunch of CEOs to suddenly give $500 million to people.
So I want to take you back a few years to a couple of young lads with dreams and ambition who are, in the dank South Florida warehouse trying to imagine a future, and realized, much like Luke Skywalker standing on Tatooine out of two suns, probably getting some sort of retinal disease too. We've got to look into that. Thinking to ourselves, man, there's the far end of the universe. We're the farthest from it. Nothing's happening here.
Standing above the smoking corpse of my aunt and uncle, I was like, I got to get the hell out of this place.
There's nothing going on here. Like there were two exciting bits of technology that actually happened in South Florida. One was that was where IBM developed the PC. And I think I actually took you there, Justin. Didn't I take you once to the original campus in Boca Raton?
That sounds familiar. That sounds like something that would have happened after an Arby's trip.
I have a lot of crazy field trips I would do. So that was
this is actually a true story. Not uncommon. You go to Arby's, you go to Taco Bell, and then it's like, hey, what are you doing for the next hour? I don't know. All right. And you're driving out and you're in the middle of nowhere. It's like some place that you've probably driven by a million times since it's like in the area. And you're like, oh man, what's this? Huh? Marilyn Manson's house. Like, oh, cool. And then that's it. You just leave. It's a fun time.
Yeah. Field trips. So field trips. There was the Boca Raton factory. Then there was down the road from where we went to high school, okay, the Motorola factory, which used to make police radios. This big Motorola facility back when Motorola was a big thing. This big, huge facility in Plantation in the town we grew up and went to school. And then, things went away from Motorola, and that place just became this sort of, I don't know what happened. I was actually got to go there once because I was in high school. I couldn't just be any nerd. I had to be a nerd that was in like the Motorola Junior Engineers program or something like that. But there was a really cute girl, Maggie Gallagher, in there. That's kind of why I wanted to be in it. And we got to go to a trip there, and I was in like this Motorola newsletter there on the facility, all that. Well, fast forward several years later, here we are in South Florida going, we got to leave. We gotta leave. Yeah. There's nothing going on. Nothing going on.
Enough for us here, man.
And thank goodness you guys got the hell out of that backwater. Look at you, Justin, up there in the Silicon Valley. That's where it's all happening in Northern California. Look at you, Andrew Main, right there in Hollywood, California. I'm the only dumb in stupid old Austin, Texas. I'm in the backwater.
Doing well.
But guess what happens in our hometown plantation? Magic Leap, which actually is based out of Dania, which the only thing Dania is really known for was like having a bunch of wild monkeys, is... I went on a whole expedition once to find them. I actually found a submarine in the woods. It's a whole other story. Yeah. But anyhow.
That and the Racerama. Going super local here. I said that and the Racerama. Going super local.
Oh, yeah. It used to be right near where Six Flags Over Atlantis was, too. They bought the Motorola campus. Magic Leap bought that campus now because they say they're hinting that they're close to manufacturing. They say they're close to having an actual physical product that you'd be able to purchase and buy. They've dropped hints about this, but they say yes. And this is a facility that you might want to build things at, or you'd want to, you know, you could prototype big on a large scale, developer models, whatever, before outsourcing to other parts of the country or doing assembly or whatever. That's happening in our hometown after we left. One of the most exciting things in entertainment and virtual reality, augmented reality. They waited for us to leave. And that Motorola place, by the way, Justin, what was it across the street from?
A strip club?
Arby's.
Oh,
hell yeah.
Big Arby's, like their corporate, like, you know, the store where they try to.
Yeah. Now I know what you're talking about. Well, you know, here's the funny thing about Magic Leap is that it is unique in that it is tied to Google based on its funding, and yet it is not owned by Google. It seems to be, at the very least, in terms of the press narrative, kind of the best, most impressive thing that only seven people in the world have seen. As soon as HoloLens came out, they came out with their own possibly more impressive thing, although they did not demonstrate what kind of equipment you would have to have on your head to experience what they demoed. There really is no, you know, there's only two like endings to this story, right? Like either they're game changers or they're the segue, right? Like, well, this is.
And by the way, you know, you could do worse than be the segue. You could be the guys that overstate the importance of your world-changing technology only to, you know, have people drive around and take architecture tours using them.
Well, remember, what's the legacy? What's the full legacy of Segway right now, though?
It's downstairs in my kitchen on the standing on the two wheels Segway that you could ride all around nowadays.
Yeah, so it was where they said, we have this market we're going to carve out for us where people are using golf carts and stuff. Chinese manufacturers like, hey, you know who, like, who else would want this? Everybody. I actually did a classroom thing over 10 years ago talking about Segway and where it would get more interesting if it scaled up to like motorcycles and stuff. But
Did you guys see I want to say that it was yesterday or the day before on Reddit, I saw that somebody was taking Segway technology for disabled folks.
That's been their actual project. Segway has this super wheelchair that goes upright.
No. This is not the upright one because you're right. Michael Kamen, Dean Kamen. He was first to realize that folks who were in a wheelchair, you know, I don't know, maybe would want to stand at the same height as people who they're having a discussion with. So they made chairs that stood up. But somebody has specifically said, no, it's still a chair, but this thing goes wicked fast and you never have to use your arms. I don't think that's, or I guess I'm sure this is some version of it on there, the Magic Leap thing this week, they also, Magic Leap released a new video, right?
Well, that's, yes, we should get to that. Do we have
go ahead. I have not seen this video. This is the Magic Leap demo. We are looking now under a desk and we see a little floating robot that kind of looks, pardon the phrase, like a floating robot chicken.
And it says here the entire time across the bottom, it says shot directly through Magic Leap technology on October 14th, 2015. No special effects or compositing were used in the creation of these videos, which I mean, here's the crummy part is I mean, I'm sure that that is an absolutely factually true statement insofar as it goes. But, I mean, you can't help but give an impression just based on and we're seeing some very amazing demos, but it's like, I don't know what that means.
Let's describe it before you kill the joy, Brian.
Sorry.
So right now we are seeing the solar system as it orbits around the sun next to what looks to be a secretary sitting at the front desk of possibly Magic Leap. What's fascinating is that you are the camera is zooming in depth of field to these augmented reality creations and out of focus with the woman behind her. Like this making this to be a very, very realistic. You are seeing something that very much looks created, and it is like kind of oddly floating in this weird adjusting kind of way, but it is something that seems to have weight and presence in your field of vision.
Yeah, and the quality of the render is extraordinary. The art is beautiful. The color is vibrant. I mean, it really does look like the only thing weird about this demo is how uninterested the secretary is in the fact that there's a 3D floating model of the solar system over her shoulder.
From her point of view, there's just a camera there with something attached to the front.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, no, from her point of view, it's just her boss leering at her again.
Yeah, man. No, it looks fantastic. And I guess the things that we really want to judge are the resolution and the tracking capability, right? Because if you watch it, I mean, the tracking capability seems really, really, really good.
Three things now, because we took one for granted with Microsoft HoloLens. We want resolution.
Yep.
Resolution, tracking, four things. Resolution, tracking, frame rate, and field of view.
Field of view was the big nut that the Oculus was first to crack, because a friend of mine has only one eye. His other eye got poked out as a kid. He was one of the first backers of Oculus because he was like, I just want it for the field of view. I want to feel like I'm in a place and to have motion tracked head movements and all that stuff.
So what?
And that's been the thing that hurt us the most and made us feel bad about HoloLens.
So what is
the lagginess?
What are the ingredients?
Oh, that's right.
What are the ingredients for Magic Leap taking the Magic Leap into immortality based on and paying off the hype? What do we need to see from it, and what are the things that we would be disappointed if it did not meet upon them revealing more?
Can I give my theory on this? I think Andrew is 100% right. I think field of view, you said field of view, resolution. Do you say depth of field? You put that in there?
No, frame rate.
Frame rate and tracking capability, right? And I guess, given in there is stereoscopic vision, that's novel or whatever.
We'll assume.
I'm going to say that of all the players, the winner of this game, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, is the one that has a single game or function that it ships with, that from a software, from an IP, from a storytelling perspective, is what people love. And we gave this example a year ago when we talked about it, but I could not count the number of people who I knew as a child who had a Nintendo Entertainment System and never bought another game besides just playing the Super Mario Brothers that it came with. That was all it took. Same thing with Wii Sports. There were people who bought Wii machines and only played Wii Sports because it did that one thing very well. That is going to be the winner of this game.
I would disagree, and only because I think that the killer app is crucial to establishing dominance. But to me, that's one step beyond where we've seen anybody prove, which is you need the hardware to be unobtrusive, to be something that you don't feel completely tethered to something, maybe field of motion around a room and not just 2 feet away from your desk or possibly hardwired into something. And it's got to feel natural. I mean, for AR compared to VR for me is something that very much says, hey, if I work by myself or I work in a small office, I want to be able to keep this thing on my head for a substantial portion of the day, because it's going to give me functionality that I would not have otherwise. That to me is the bright, beautiful future of AR. And as much as a lot of this stuff looks super rad and super amazing, I think it will be a disappointment if it is underpowered or bulky on your head or uncomfortable on your head.
Well, and that's the big unknown in this regard, right? That's that we know virtually nothing about what the headgear, the software, the hardware, the tech specs.
But it's like VR, I'll put something weird on my head for, you know, to play a game. If the game is killer for, you know, 30 minutes, like, and when I take it off, I'll be like, oh, geez, thank God I got that thing off my head. But AR, I don't think I would do that. I think that I would want more passive, persistent feature from it.
My take on it is I think it's a very valid point, Brian, but my question would be, and I see that really with really, especially with VR, you know, the game, the group with the, you know, the really killer VR game is the one that might dominate. But, you know, Microsoft certainly in AR with, you know, Minecraft and showing all the Minecraft demos has kind of positioned it like, yeah, you get this. This is the awesome game you're going to want to play forever in it. Where this is going to be probably a lot more than like the Wii's or those Nintendo systems were. You're looking at an impulse buy that's far ahead of what anybody has impulse buyed before, purchased before. Where I bought a Wii, you know, bought a Nintendo 64 when it first came out. I bought these things because they have the one cool game.
Right.
Because they're at that right price point. Above there, it becomes, you know, a much more, well, I need to be able to justify this kind of thing.
So in that regard, I wonder if the right play, because again, we haven't heard any projections on price or anything. I wonder if the right play isn't some version of the Tesla model. You know, a number of car companies had come along trying to sell electric cars before Tesla, but Tesla said, no, here's what we're going to do. We're going to tackle the highest of the high end where price is, you know, no object to these people. We're going to do it very, very well, and we're going to work our way down from there. Maybe there's a specific technical or engineering or manufacturing capability that you could do with this where all of a sudden it's worth it to buy a $50,000 unit for five workers that otherwise might not be the case.
Industrial is certainly an interesting play, you know, and that if you go after a sector like that, you tackle the developer problem because you're not saying, hey, everybody, come develop for this thing that only has, you know, fewer people than the Jaguar had, you know.
Yeah.
Or Neo Geo or whatever, you know, one of those like high-end platforms that just wasn't enough, you know, developer support. I think when I tried the HTC Vive, I was ready to take out my checkbook. If they said this thing was $1,000, you know, I was there. You know, I'm like, that experience was where Oculus was so many of these sort of, yeah, well, the next gen that'll have this, next gen it'll have this, it'll have this. The HTC Vive where, you know, I'm walking around the room, actually walking around and the room shifting with me.
Yeah.
I'm like, this was – Oculus was a thing that I wanted to maybe consider creating and developing for. HTC was something that I wanted to play and for hours on time. And I think I may still be inside of there right now. I'm not convinced otherwise.
I mean, that's actually, you know, to put a true weird thing spin on it. I mean, that's – was it Stephen Hawking that said that all things being equal, it might be more likely that we're in a simulation than the universe is actually what we think it is.
That was actually an Andrew Main Monkey Man class that I did too. You know,
I was there, Brian. Where were you?
College. I'm sorry.
but Andrew, I mean, do you think that form factor and comfortability is partly the difference between AR and VR?
You know. It's going to be certainly if you're looking at AR as a thing, as you pointed out, that you're going to use during the day as some sort of assist. Absolutely. I thought, you know, and I said this before I put on the Vive, you know, I was out on a patio of this developer's building and the conversation was, well, how do you create content that's short enough and people want to do it before people get tired? You know, we're all talking about how you're only going to wear this thing for a little while. Then we all go upstairs, we go through the door, and then we come out the door. Actually, it's a staircase. It was an open loft. We come back down going, I didn't want to leave. I wasn't going to care about the time. It didn't matter. I just wanted to stay. And it's like, oh, you know, we're thinking about the wrong thing, you know?
Well, think about our smartphones, right? There was a time as little as, what, 7 years ago, that you got a bunch of eye rolling about like, oh, great, connected, tethered to the internet at all times. I guess this is who we are nowadays. And now I think clearly, you know, the people have spoken, and it's like, yeah, man, we'll give up, you know, basic utilities before we, you know, get cut off from society. Internet's a human right, and we deserve to be connected to the hive mind at all times.
Oh, no, by the way, those people still exist. They're in San Francisco, and they go on summer camps with each other.
I mean, the point is there's few of them now than ever before. You know, it's like we are seeing a tipping point where all of a sudden it feels right to have a smartphone in your pocket at all time, and you feel this expectation like you should be able to reach out to anyone anytime for any reason to share anything audiovisually. I could totally believe that 10, 15 years from now, that will be our default expectation with AR. From the moment I wake up, I should be able to put on glasses and live in the better version of the world than the stupid, meatless, disconnected, than the animal version that most of us live in now.
Okay, but let me ask you this. If next year is to be the year of AR, what needs to happen? What does the magic leap need to be? How does it need to be better than HoloLens?
I mean, given that we have scant details on both of them.
We don't know jack about either, right? I think Microsoft has been a little bit more, upfront about some of the limitations of HoloLens, which has kind of cooled some of the some of the hype machine. Magic Leap keeps kind of insinuating that, like, yeah, whatever. They're on, like, you know, old yesterday's version of the new hotness that we got cooking up here in Plantation, Florida.
I guess the bummer about this discussion is that the answer is going to be different. The 5-year answer is different than the 50-year answer as far as what's going to win. You know, and the 5-month.
Let's get out of. Stop, anarcho-libertarian, stop, stop. Everybody drives a self-driving car.
Let me actually answer the question here. Is because what will get you through the next 5 years has to be something adorable. So it has to be something that is relatable, that is specific, and that is the problem. Is I can't think of what that thing is. I can think of a million things that 5 years from now I would like to see displayed on lenses. You know, augmenting my reality. But I also do not believe for one second that we're going to see anything a year from now for Magic Leap that does not involve a 8-pound backpack that you wear in order to power it the entire time.
Andrew?
I mean, I don't, you know, we have this idea. Once we see the thing and what we think the form of the thing, it takes a lot longer for these things to happen. You know, I was talking to a developer about the HTC Vive, and I'm like, oh, this is great. I can't wait for, you know, to see it when it comes out next year. And she's a person, she talks to them, she's like, oh no, it's coming out this year. It's coming out. I'm like, no, it's not. She's like, oh no, it's December. They told me it's gonna be shipping in December. I'm like, it's great that they told you that. I promise you, the consumer version of this will not be ready this year. You know? She's like, oh well, I know differently. A month later, HTC announces shipping next year. You know,
sure.
And so there, yeah, there's the headline premiering. It ain't that don't mean that it's going to be like you're all going to be able to like buy it, you know. Again, you know, these things are hard, and it's not, this thing is an amazing piece of technology, and I'm super excited about it. But, you know, that thing got pushed back. And, you know, from when we see Magic Leap to when it's in our hands, and we want to believe because these people are so funded, and the guy before, you know, Abramovitz, the guy who's, you know, behind this, is seems to be kind of a pretty brilliant kind of guy. He's getting more outspoken that maybe they're already buying a factory, that maybe they're just gonna jump right in. But there's been a history sometimes of these things where, you know, what was the big huge, you know, over in like daily grocery delivery startup,
Peapod back in the day,
Cosmos.
No, it was like they had like $1 billion of the funding. They had an entire factory and shipping facility Web and van? Everything like that. It was one. What's that?
Was it Webvan?
Maybe Webvan. Yeah, Webvan. And that was one of those things that, like, hey, everything looked like it was in play. Remember Transmeta? Do you remember that? So Transmeta, no. Way back in the day, that was in Linus Torvald, the guy who created Linux. And a group of other people were hired to go work for this secret, stealthy startup. They put up this one little page, like the future of mobile computing or something. And they were going to leapfrog Intel and AMD and everybody else with this mobile you know, the super efficient chip platform with something called Code Morphine and all this. And that was like this big, exciting, like, oh my gosh, this is going to be, well, you know, Motorola, excuse me, Intel wasn't sitting around. You know, everybody else is like, yeah, we think mobile is going to be a pretty important place too. And we're going to put a bunch of energy and efforts into that. And I think Transmeta shipped some chips for a while, but it just ended up, you know, not happening, even though the talent was there. But these things are hard.
So of all the consumer devices to launch, and again, I guess this discussion, we're all assuming it's going to be a consumer device. I mean, I just think of the iPhone. The iPhone made that leap. The problem is a device that can do anything does nothing in the mind of the people who might be buying it. And we saw that with the Wii U. The Wii was a success because it did one thing. It played Wii Sports and it was a lot of fun. The Wii U was a failure because it could do anything with this iPad-like feature and blah, blah, blah. And because it could do anything, it did nothing. The iPhone, I think, was a really good example of a...
Hello?
Blip, 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 blip. Check, 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 check. They cut off. It's Apple. They're trying to shut me down.
Steve Jobs tells you to be careful from beyond.
Yeah, all right. Calm down, Sorkin.
The Apple, the iPhone eventually did everything. But when it launched, it was extremely, extremely simple. He said, you know, three things. It is a mobile computing device, a smartphone, and the best iPod that we've ever made. Which, if you think about what the iPhone is now to everyone who has one, is a ridiculously small, narrow-minded, almost ignorant, dumb way to pitch it at the time, and yet it was 100% right, and it made all the money.
Well, but remember, the big thing was internet communicator, was the idea of Safari in your pocket, and at that point, mobile browsing prior to that was a nightmare, you know, and then with Pinch and Zoom, and what's that?
Hot garbage.
Yeah, it was garbage. And then it was like the idea, we're all talking about, oh, we need to format for mobile, and the answer was no. Don't format for mobile. Just have a device that lets you do that. That was the killer feature for me. Killer feature for me was to actually pull up real web pages on a phone.
What if that
Well, and
is...
also, this is my favorite thing, my favorite little artifact of that point in time, is if you go back and watch that keynote, among the biggest applause breaks is Steve Jobs scrolling in iTunes. Just like that, the smooth scroll action of was it iOS then, or was it something else? But basically, just the idea of TouchOS, that it would scroll as if it were just a dial and it wasn't a button and it wasn't anything that you went like boop boop boop, just pop the crowd like anything else. And so really, what was amazing was what was revolutionary was. Touch, just the touch interface being a reality and actually being ready for prime time, the mobile interface, and the fact that as a phone, it wasn't loaded with bloated ass crapware and had the visual voicemail and stuff like that.
Oh
like
my
it just
God.
Felt
visual
like a
voicemail just felt like the freaking future back at the time. Yeah.
And I think Brian, to your point that, you know, when you invent a new product category, you know, iPhones and Androids, it's like by that time everybody had a phone and like, well, what am I going to do when I replace this device? Oh, get this new device. And even the iPad to an extent was sort of like, you know, I use my laptop a little bit, but mainly for browsing. And it's like, well, let's get rid of the keyboard you don't use because you're illiterate. And all of a sudden, boom, you've got this great device.
All right, so
that
I actually have a theory. That solves all of the discussion points that we have. It makes Magic Leap viable in the short term, must have experience. It gets them over the 5 to 10 year hump to where people start developing in clever ways. And it satisfies a longing that we've had for as long as we've been alive. What if the must have utility for this, because this would solve the computing problem. You wouldn't have to worry about backpacks. It would solve the power problem. It would solve it would leave you hungering like you had with the Vive experience for more afterwards. What if, let's say, Avatar 3 is a $40 ticket and every theater that shows it has to have seats outfitted with a massive central computer that, that can handle the processing power. You get an augmented reality visual movie experience where not it doesn't create an optical illusion of stuff coming out of the screen, but stuff comes out of the actual screen and is behind you, and you turn around and you see, you know, the tendrils of the weeping trees or whatever all around you. And then you're left thinking like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we just had that all the time, if our whole world looked like that? That is something that people would pay for, the limited engagement experience. It solves the power problem, so it solves the computing problem, and it solves the content problem. I think that is how something like Magic Leap can make its entrance on the mainstream.
It would not solve the movie theater patron lice problem, which might be an issue if you're reusing headsets for people. You know, I think we already do.
I mean, we already recycle our glasses.
I mean, it's 15 years for theaters to go digital, and I don't see them lining up to go do this experience, which is then designed for people to buy a consumer product that they'll then go at home and never go to a theater again. And it doesn't – how do you connect that to, I want this at home? Didn't work for 3D movies and 3D TVs. And if Magic Leap's saying, hey, we want to sell you this device that it's like, oh, it's this thing I used to watch Avatar. Like, no, it's for everything else.
I mean, everything that Magic Leap has shown has been about you in your office. You know, the big thing that they showed, that where they wanted to drop their nuts on Microsoft's table after the HoloLens demo, was looking at email and having that seamlessly play into...
Drop your nuts on Microsoft's table. Okay.
I mean, you know, like you know, as if it were you know, like a hardware store. So they but look at it. I mean, you are at your office. You are dealing with stuff at your office, and then you decide you want to screw off for a little and play a fun game because you have the ability to with this, you know, brand new, amazing, awesome Magic Leap system. You know, I think what they want to do is they want to pop you like the iPhone popped you when you saw, like, oh my God, wait, my day-to-day life will be different if I buy this creation. And I hope, you know, listen, especially because they're South Florida, you know, guys, you know, I hope they do. I hope that they can crack that code, but I think that that's where their future lies. That's where their destiny lies.
I'm not going to rule out that, like, all of a sudden you're going to go to shopping malls everywhere and there's going to be lines of people to go play Avatar, see what Avatar looks like when you put the sucker on your head and do that. I absolutely think that it's, you want to get out there and put it, you know, get it as front as many people as you can so they all go, but then you need to have that, and this is why you buy it. You know, I get, you know, what happens next. And that's, what's the killer app? You know, for me, if it's like, hey, you know, hey guys, you know what? We can all put on our helmets and we can go to a park in our own city, yet the three of us can interact and I will see virtual versions of you and we can go raid a castle. Done.
And we've talked about it and there's no end to my excitement about that possibility, but that is a vast improvement in a fidelity of experience, and in the consumer realm, convenience trumps fidelity. Yes, the iPhone was a high fidelity experience, but more importantly, it was a highly convenient experience, which is, I think, what really launched it ahead in the early days.
No, I think what's really interesting is the idea that, you know, you saw when the iPad was launched that, you know, a lot of people very much enjoyed email. Mm-hmm. You know, that the idea of email in a larger touch OS, and really I very much believe that the tale of tablets as we know them right now would be vastly different if we had better, better, cheaper mobile internet. I think that has totally hampered the growth of tablets. But that being said,
For the record, no doubt. I mean, I don't even know. My kids would barely have any interest in the, you know, 50-inch television in the living room because at home they have Wi-Fi most of the time. If they had that level, you know, 100 megabit internet available on mobile at all times, I would never see them again. I mean, they would be off doing their own things.
But I think what would be interesting for AR is let's even keep looking at email. Let's say you were able to, by way of, you know, having your field of vision or you know, maybe slight eye gestures become part of the user interface. Can you get through stuff quicker if that's, you know, put into or your voice recognition is part of that? You know, can you burn through emails quicker? Can you go through your to-do list different and quicker? Does that just provide a different form and function for how you operate on your daily life? Because if that's the case, then maybe it's worth it to have kind of a long
course. Dude, hold on. Now you're talking my language here, because remember, what was that technology that displayed words one at a time and tricked you into reading 2 to 3 times faster?
Spritz theoretically tricked you into reading.
Yeah, with decent comprehension. And I don't know, I believe it. Certainly as much as I am able to retain and comprehend, you know, audiobooks that I listen to at 1.25, 1.5 speed.
Yeah, the comprehension question's actually been questioned.
Well, regardless, if I could put on
Brian, that's what I learned doing it.
Regardless, if I could put on a pair of goggles and all of a sudden my Gmail inbox was not a battleground, it did not feel like a stack of papers, but instead it was a game where it's like, hey, here's how it's going to go. I'm going to show this to you. You're going to make a decision right now. It's either going to vanish forever or you're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. No more punting on your emails or whatever. And a virtual assistant walked you through and says, okay, so let's get the dictation. Let's say what you want to say. I don't know. If I was guided through productivity better, I would spend thousands, plural, of dollars to condense this
question,
time.
Though, Brian. Why does putting that into AR or whatever make it better than just having it on your screen? How does having that help other than making it prettier or eye candy?
I that's a very good question, and I look forward to what solutions they provide for me to come up with that. Because
I would say the ability to use your field of vision as an effective user interface, and depending on what your interaction tools are. I don't know whether it could. I just think that there is a difference between form and function
For example, we think about our finances different now that we live in an age of being able to open up Mint on our phone, right? And a lot of that is, you know, we could teleport back 10, 15 years, like, well, how would it change anything to have an icon showing how much growth you've had this year? You know,
that's really different. That's really, really different analogy.
I disagree. The only difference is that we have the benefit of hindsight because we're 15 years ahead of that question, whereas you're asking me to project and make up, you know, it's not for me to
An icon is a thing that says, let me make this thing that's pervasive and right in front of you on this device when you pull out your phone that's going to be in front of you. You're saying, I sit down, I put this on, and there's my email, versus I sit down, front of my screen is my email.
Balloon Knots does make a point that there are studies that say multiple monitors do help with productivity. So theoretically, if you could put as many and as large of monitors and you could have adjustable font and stuff like that to a greater and more unlimited degree, then maybe that would increase productivity. But the answer to that question is, but I think that
I mean, all I know is that Andrew Main from 15 years from now is going to scoff at the idea that Andrew Main of 2015 questioned what the benefit of working in an AR environment would be. I mean, the answer is it'll be a billion small improvements that make it more effective.
Mine was when we say we're going to take this thing that we know right now, email, whatever, like it, and we're going to put it into here. Where I'm thinking like, the benefit's when we create new ways of doing things. You know, when we say, do we need to have this thing now that we have this better way to interact or do that?
Well,
I'm a believer. I think the final form of AR, by the way, isn't going to be a headset. It's going to be a little box that sits on top of a TV or a monitor that projects directly into your eye. So you don't, you know, it's hard for us to adopt, you know, no sane person uses a Bluetooth thing in their ear anymore, you know, because it's like, I don't want to put this thing here. Yet it's amazingly convenient when you have one in there and you can press the button and have Siri and do that. But and I'm the guy that, like, I love the Apple Watch, but look.
Quitter. By the way, Strength says, whatever happens to the tech that wins will be the one that the porn industry chooses. That's such a fallacy. The porn industry bets on literally every technology. And so it just so happens that, like, oh, look, their bet came in. They like every single technology the porn industry goes in on. Speaking of making questionable decisions for money, you can support this program by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. This is where we will continue to do this show for you. The dedication that we have to you guys is tremendous. We had to delay this this podcast because I was on a flight to Denver, Colorado. Then I had to drive to Vail. I was late. I missed my first flight. And yet we stood vigil and did this show for you. It's because of the people that support us, and we would like you to join our cause. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now, let me remind you guys that if you want to get down to the bottom of the goblin crisis, that's going to mean we need to put a man on the ground in Africa to investigate that. And that man is right here.
Yep.
Listening.
Apparently.
Bryce.
Hi. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, are we really going to send Bryce to Africa?
I'm kind of tempted just to like take all the Patreon money so far and then have all of us kick in our own money on top of it and just send him out with a camera and say, like, don't come back until you got goblins.
This seems like a terrible idea. This is irresponsible if we send Bryce to Africa.
It would be bad. It would probably not be a pleasant thing. It might make me twist a little bit.
Bad experience, good art. I think it'll be great art.
All right, Bryce, here. Let's just put it to you right now.
Okay.
This is all a setup. We did buy your ticket to Zimbabwe. Apparently there is a goblin crisis. You leave tomorrow. What are your emotions?
Panic. I don't know any. I don't know a lot about Africa.
You go there. You say, hey, what's
Fresh
up?
Eyes.
I'm Neshkam. Everyone knows the show.
Plus, granted, it's not Africa we want you to be an expert on. It's the goblins that we need you to be an expert on, and you know everything you need to know about the goblins.
I think there's a good chance I would rush over to Michael's and get doll making supplies.
Wait,
so I could
what?
Have a fake goblin.
Oh, you would just would just make sure that you delivered. Okay, yeah. Like I was sent to
the
deliver a goblin. It's just the Lion King playing in the background on a television with some dolls. And he's like, oh, I'm a goblin. Get back, Scar.
I found him. Yeah.
We're like some guy in a Pizza Hut uniform shoved in front of the camera. Jumbo! $12. Can I go now? Bryce is, of course, like any brave, intrepid explorer, is playing off the anxiety and how nervous he is. He really wants to do this. And to make this happen, we need your support. And on the last episode, Brian alluded to the idea that we might try to manufacture such a thing using sound effects and stuff, like a radio play if Bryce was to go to Africa.
Right.
And that's although fake. It would be arranged in such a way you would not be able to prove that we did that.
Well, I mean, that's what Arthur C. Clarke said in his famous fisticuffs debate with Alan Turing. He said, as long as the radio show sounds good enough, it's like you're there. And then he punched him. Did that not happen, or did I just listen to a radio show of that?
You had me for a moment there. Oh my when did this happen?
Arthur C. Clarke.
We want to make this thing happen because I've got more goblin information for you all.
Uh-oh.
Now, we talked about before, we talked about some goblin busters who went into a village and actually caught a goblin last time.
Yeah. Right? Showed him off and everything.
There was a bit of skepticism here. There was a suspicion.
Yeah, well, they burned the body, it doesn't bode well for a further scientific examination.
All right, skeptics, here's what I want you to do, all right? I'm going to give you a situation, a scenario, if you will.
Roger.
Our little Bryce, hops off the plane. He's got his camera in hand, maybe a little cage. Maybe we send him with a little rabbit cage to go capture a goblin, okay?
Okay.
We find out a report in a village. He goes to the village and says, hello, I'm Bryce. I'm the goblin hunter. I'm like, ooh, yeah, thank you. He's here. Yay. Okay. Bryce captures a goblin. What should he do with this next?
Does he have a cage? He has it in a cage, right?
It's a cage.
How about we go ahead and start with a picture?
He captures it in a suitcase. You know, Justin, enough with the pictures, okay? He gets it in a suitcase. He's actually got – picture's going to be faked, Justin. He's caught this thing in a suitcase. He has it in a suitcase. What's the responsible thing to do?
I mean, to kill it so it can neither escape nor harm other people, right?
I mean –
well, what would you
– you'd want to imprison it in something suitcase.
What you would want to do is you would want to wrap your muscular hands right around its fragile half-sized neck and just squeeze until you can no longer hear the wheezing. And once it stops twitching, give it an extra 90 seconds just
all
in
right,
case.
Ted Bundy. I want you to imagine you caught a goblin in your house and you're pretty sure it's not one of your children and you have it in a suitcase, right? Goblin. I need a goblin in a suitcase noise. Right. What do you do?
I mean, first of all, you put that suitcase in a bigger suitcase and then you bust out the duct tape. And then you just question how strong your grip strength is and how brave you are.
What do you do with this?
So your question, like it's not like you call.
You'd want to bring in other authorities. I mean, you want to bring more people in on this.
Yeah, not me. Authorities can shut this down. Keep the conspiracy on the inside. I go live on the internet with like 5 different cameras. Go to diamondclub.tv. And then I drill a little hole, and you know what I do? Is I go to Reddit, and I lie. I say, I found a safe in my basement. I wonder what's in it. Once I'm on the front page, then I reveal, no, actually, I caught a goblin. Take a look. And then we have the wisdom of the crowds working for us.
Yeah, they're like, oh, look, scam school guy hacking the system, buddies of Justin Robert Young and Night Attack and Andrew Main from Don't Trust Andrew Main, says he found a goblin.
I swear to God, to keep this show's legitimacy, I'm going to have to do some kind of television program called The Most Trustworthy Guy in America, Justin Robert Young.
All seriousness, you catch this weird thing in your suitcase, what do you do?
I'm joking, but also I am 100% serious in that I want to maximize visibility of this thing. The reason that we don't believe in Bigfoot is because we have a few scant photos that are out of focus and a million things. I want as much proof as possible of what's happening as I could possibly get in as many people to see it, which is, I mean, why naturally I would go to Times Square and have a big exhibition. Behold, the giant goblin. I mean,
real world, what are you going to do with this thing?
I am serious. I go live first, and I'm gonna crowdsource the response,
I'm gonna bring this thing to a jail, some kind of enclosed system, a zoo, something like that, a cage, and then I'm going to open it up, and I'm gonna bring in other people to verify and understand this a magical creature which has apparently been terrorizing things.
So nobody is just going to bring it right to the cops?
No. Oh, good God, no. No way.
I said bring it to a jail. Bring it to authorities.
Okay. No. Yeah, yes. If it was a tiger, I would call animal control. If it's a Tyrannosaurus, maybe the cops aren't the best equipped guys.
Well, hold on, wait a minute.
Handle the Tyrannosaurus. Gotcha.
How much have we seen of it? Have we seen enough of this before we put it in the suitcase to know that it is something special?
You've seen the thing. It's real to you. You've seen it. You got on the suitcase. I'm like,
I'm bringing it to either the zoo or the cops, some kind of enclosed structure.
Okay, all right, look, Justin, I'm really glad you and I finally captured this goblin. We got a decision. We're either going to take it to the cops or to the zoo.
Yeah,
I am not cool with taking it to the cops. It's a waste of their time. They don't do animal control. They're probably going to end up shooting this thing. Let's take it to the zoo. I maybe a research facility. We could call
it's
you.
It's dead, Brian.
It's fine. Plus, they'd probably just try to arrest its dead corpse. So let's go to the zoo where they could do something useful with it.
Wait a minute. Hold on. The goblin's dead in the thing?
I mean, it is now. Did you hear it screaming inside? Dead. I put it in 5 suitcases, and then I zip-tied them all up.
Five? Like, why are we dead set on killing this? Fine. All right. If it's dead, then we take it to the zoo. We take it to the zoo.
We can maybe call the university, University of Texas.
We autopsy it.
Wait, us?
Well, not we. We go to a zoo collector, a zoo-man.
Right, but we help him sell
Hans
tickets.
Zoom-in. Excuse
me, somebody give me an X-Acto knife.
But we help him sell tickets for the autopsy of the millennium, right?
Oh, my God, PT. You just, I mean, like, everything's the Fiji mermaid with you. You know, just whatever. Well, we're going to try and break scientific ground. Our names will be in textbooks forever.
Gentlemen. This situation actually happened.
What?
Oh my God. A family from Buawe, Nikita 7 suburb, dumped its tenant goblin at the Tshabala police station, sending cops fleeing in different directions.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one where you got to make a call, and you got to have one cop come out. And you got to make sure you vet him a little bit before you show him the goods. You can't just roll into the bookings desk and just roll out a goblin corpse and say, "Sup, Holmes."
I mean, and it was dead. It was a bizarre creature which had a terrible odor. Which, by the way, it's like maybe me. It was overpowered and burned after wreaking havoc. Oh, my God. So a smelly thing got captured and burned, possibly alive, and then they took the corpse to the cops and said, "Why don't you arrest this goblin corpse, cops?"
And then the cops ran away.
Arrested for disturbing the peace and quiet that we had before we started setting it on fire.
Goblin police, arrest this corpse.
Oh, my God. I feel awful about this because I strongly suspect it's not an actual goblin. And it makes me wonder whether it's either a primate, a goblin-like primate, or a human being. If it was a human being, that's really not great.
Did you read, like, the bottom where it talked about the different kinds of cops fleeing?
No. What does it say about him?
I think
cops,
some. This is a quote. I think some
cops,
people went
cops,
out through the windows
because for their lives screaming.
Yeah, I think some people went through all the windows because we could not all have fitted through the door. Quote: "Fat cops and slim cops all ran for their lives screaming."
Yo, like, every kind of cop.
Dr. Seuss apparently here for the quote.
The cops, they ran in droves, they did. The fat one, the thin ones, and all in between.
We need to write that storybook, taking the goblin to the police station.
The smart cops, the dumb ones, even gamer cops too. All of them ran. And you sure would too. The goblin, it stank. It did defile. Stick around. It said for a while. Then you and I read too many fucking. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, market. Have to work blue with the Dr. Seuss humor.
What explanation have you? Could you not have taken it to the zoo?
Then finally, the goblin's mother did arrive. Now stop it, you sillies. Now go back home, hide. This is why we don't visit the people of Earth. Leave them to their increasing girth. Obesity will take them all eventually. No,
said, all right, I'm all done. Awake, said the smoldering corpse. And then you leave it on a cliffhanger. Let's go ahead and get to picks.
Holy cow, man. I have a pick that I'm supposed to say and a pick that I want to say. I'm going to say the one that I want to say. Goofing off last night, I got roped in. And Brian Curley of Drunk Kids Gaming said he wanted to play Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes. But he had traditionally been the guy who defuses the bomb. For those of you who don't know, the game is you have a bomb and you have one person who just is able, you're able to manipulate objects and do it. The other team or person has a PDF document and that's it. That's all they have. So they have to ask questions. It's a game of communications. They're not allowed to see the bomb that you are defusing. You argue. They want to know questions like, does the serial number end in a vowel? Is it even number? Is there anything blinking in Morse code? If so, then give us the dots and the dashes. And you have 3 minutes or less to defuse the bomb. And what started as just me and Brian Curley eventually got up to a team of 5 people, including our producer, Bryce Castillo. 4 o'clock this morning, we are going nuts trying to defuse an 11-segment bomb in 3 minutes. It was such a blast. It was so much fun. I cannot recommend it enough. Keep talking and no one explodes. It's great, 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 great.
That is so exceptional. And it just speaks to how awesome indie gaming is now, that like we are, you know, the true legacy of PC gaming is really in, it's not in the like, oh, here's the pure superior version of playing the AAA titles, although Brian is certainly a proponent of that, but really it is just in this like, hey, you want to know what, let's just get back to like game mechanics and what is fun and what's fun with your friends if you can communicate over the internet and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and this is just such a great example.
We're looking at, if you go to bombdefusal.com or was it?
Bombmanual.com.
Bombmanual.com, you could take a look at the PDF. I don't know if it's part of the game or not, that I know for sure that the people who have the PDF are not supposed to be looking at the bomb, but I don't know if I think it's awesome that I was the defuser, never having read a single word of this document and just having to listen and figure out how to communicate extremely quickly under high pressure situations. And it was amazing the shorthand that we came up with, the way we would divide up jobs, and some jobs are much, much harder than others to calculate. So much fun. And to tie back in with our original discussion, originally developed, I believe, for the Oculus Rift, right? That was their whole gimmick, was this was a way for a game to take advantage of the fact that one person was having this immersive 3D experience while other people couldn't see what he was seeing. And it was his job to describe to everyone what he was looking at. So much fun. Can't recommend it enough.
And certainly a kind of a play on what have become very, very popular of the real world escape the room style games, which, this very much is a virtual echo of. I'm excited to play. That sounds so much fun.
Dude, I will play it like tonight as soon as you're done. That would be, yeah.
Andrew?
I have self plugs here. It doesn't really sound right. these are already listed on Amazon, so I'm just going to tell you here. I haven't sent out an email list or anything about this yet, okay? I have a new book coming out. And right now you could buy it on Amazon, the ebook, for $2.99, but don't do that. Don't do that. Do not buy the ebook on Amazon yet for $2.99. Sign up for my mailing list and I'm going to list it for free. It's going to be a free ebook on Amazon, How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours. It's just a collection of just some advice and some thoughts on writing and creativity, from how to write a novella in 24 hours, how to start building your empire, like how to get your email list going even if you don't know anybody. Simple questions. How long should a story be? How to write a best-selling novel on your iPhone. Little insider tips on how to make a book cover without even being an artist. Why you're staring at a blank screen and a bunch of other stuff. Now, if you want a print copy of this, you can order that from Amazon. It's just going to be $4.99. I priced it like as low as I can, where I'm not actually making – no, that's not true. I think I make like 50 cents on this. So you can get that for $4.99 if you want the paperback, but don't buy the ebook yet. Just get on my mailing list, and I'll tell you when that's free.
Man,
the other plug—it's available now on Amazon.
Real quick before we move on, can I just say how much I deeply, deeply appreciate you writing this book? Because there's a lot of people who get in the business of just giving advice, and it's all this circular, you know, it's like, for example, step one, write a book about how to write a novella in 24 hours, where it's like you are giving very practical, very real world advice from somebody who has done it. You have walked the walk, and that is what is important.
Yeah, and I've hesitated for a long time because, like, I don't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be a writer who just told everybody else about writing. I want to be a writer who wrote books that people wanted to read, and And but then I get a lot of questions. I'm like, well, let me answer some questions when I can. But I want my main thing to be my stories, not me telling you how I made them. But that being said, we do after things instead. So I did that. The other thing I have now, which you can order now, and I'm going to tell you, there's going to be an email going out another week about this, which I'll really promote it.
Oh, yeah. Snap.
Public Enemy Zero, the paperback.
Yeah. Right?
And what's cool is I used CreateSpace to make this thing, and I found out, like, I went through, like, a couple versions to try to make this thing look like a real book, and I found out I could do things like full bleeds and stuff like that.
Oh, dude, that looks amazing.
Yeah, it's got a matte finish. It's a sexy, sexy looking book.
And by the way, you don't get to humble brag and say, like, to pretend to make it look like a real book when you're a published author. I mean, it is a real book.
I wanted to look as good of a quality as something that came from, let's say, a publisher I worked with. And so I went through several versions, and I'm actually going to put other, probably do a little thing in a couple of months, which is just going to explain to people how to use CreateSpace and make something that looks good. Cause I've done things that did not look good. And, you know, you realize, like, oh, you don't want to have, you know, numbers on the first few pages, or when you do chapter headings, you don't want to have the header appear there. And how do you do that in Microsoft Word? Things that are not easy to answer. What does it mean to have orphan and window control? How many words should you have per page? You know, I get ebooks or printed books from people all the time that just look unprofessional because nobody told them. The information's not easy. And so I want to try to take what I learned and put that out there. But meanwhile, this book sells for $9.99 in paperback form. Now, via CreateSpace on Amazon, I make 46 cents on that. 46 cents. It will be regularly priced at $14.99. But you know what I'm going to do with that 46 cents? What? If you buy this book and you send me a proof of purchase, just email me like, hey, I bought this on Amazon. Here's my address. I will send you a custom book plate signed by me to you that you can stick inside the book, and you can have your own special edition. Buy it through Amazon. Tell me you did it. I will send you that. I will lose money on every single purchase, but I will gladly do this just to get you guys to buy the book and pump it up. So when I raise the price to $14.99, everybody else makes us, you know, happy.
Nailed it.
This is super awesome. And also, it's very fitting that they are coming out together, or that we are talking about them together, because the proof is in the pudding. When Andrew was talking about having the do-it-yourself journey, you know, to being a published author via your own ebooks, it was Public Enemy Zero that really gave the first traction, you know, the beyond kind of our own ecosystem for Andrew's career. You know, this is and what's awesome about it is that, you know, it's fitting that we are at now with Public Enemy Zero, and you are still learning lessons. You are still figuring out how to solve major problems on how to make your career as an author via Amazon and using these online tools something that is worthwhile and can create you know, really, really awesome product.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I'm still trying to figure that out, and I'll talk a bit about that after things. And understand, when I write a book called How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours, it's not like I'm sitting there in my jacket smoking my pipe telling you all, gather around, you know, the professor's in session. I'm trying to figure this stuff out, and it's helpful when other people say, oh, you know what? I didn't know how to do this. Now I learned this. I love that. I've been very helped by other people who've taken the time, other authors who's tried to say, let me just shrink this down and make it easier to understand. And if I can do anything, if you just get one thing out of there, I'd be very, very happy. And like I said, you can get the book for free as soon as I can flip it to free, like I think on Tuesday or Wednesday I'll be there, and I'll send out an email this week on my mailing list.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. What about you, Justin?
Man, there's been a bunch of talk about that movie from George Lucas.
Jumanji?
So I wanted to talk about it. You know, the one that everybody's been chatting
Red
about.
Tails. Red Tails? Howard the Duck.
No. Is
American
Indiana
Graffiti?
Jones. For whatever reason, I've been on an Indiana Jones kick over the last couple days. I think it was started by me going on the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland, which I've always had a very complicated relationship with because it was one of the only major rides that they didn't have at Disney World. So having, you know, been alive 30 years before I went to Disneyland, it was really the only thing that I had been deprived of. But, you know, I was just thinking, so I bought the trilogy, the Indiana Jones trilogy is available on Apple, on the store for $50. You get all three, all four Indiana Jones movies that you can download onto your device. They're, you know, especially because James Bond, the new James Bond movie is coming out. You know, I think Kevin Smith had a really funny anecdote about the first time he saw Indiana Jones, and it started with him getting into like nearly a fist fight with his friend, because his friend had seen the movie and was saying that, like, you know, oh my God, he's cooler than James Bond. You know, and if you look at those two archetypes of what is, you know, what is James Bond as kind of Uber Britannia, you know, like it is all these elements of what it is to be, you know, this awesome British person, and so with a capital B, and what Indiana Jones means to be the like capital A American hero from, you know, the world traveling and sense of adventure and who he comes in contact with, whether like that, the idea that so many times he runs parallel with the enemy. Him and the enemy have the exact same goal story-wise, and yet it is Indiana Jones's purity of motivation that makes him the good guy and not the bad guy. Is just so rad, so awesome. The movies are amazing, and he's a character that I could talk about for a million years.
You know, and it's interesting because in the conception of Indiana Jones was that he was going to be a James Bond personality. That very much was what they wanted to do. And you see that in sort of the periphery, because we always think of Indiana Jones, you know, the fedora and the bullwhip and the jacket, or maybe his professor. But then you see him, you realize that like he was supposed to have like a New York City apartment. You realize that, you know, he's got really, really nice things because he's supplementing his income. You know, when he brings the artifact back in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, they're like, oh yeah, the museum will buy this from you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the museum will not thank you for your donation, Indiana Jones.
It belongs in a museum, and their cash belongs in my pockets.
Yeah. Marcus specifically says, and the museum's glad to have, but that's what this guy's doing on sabbatical, is he's stealing stuff and, you know, putting it into museums and getting them before the bad guy.
Well, but also, I mean, that's sort of the allure. There are two things about Indiana Jones that are so iconic. One is that, you know, he's not always the best guy. He definitely murders someone in cold blood because he doesn't feel like having a fist fight against somebody with a sword, you know? On the flip side, you know, later that day, we see him as a very human individual in a way that we don't see James Bond. We see him all bruised and battered and beat to hell where he can't even handle having a sexy woman take off his clothes without wincing and griping. I mean, it's the flaws, and I mean that both in a character and physical sense that make him so appealing to us.
And if you talk about the trilogy, and you know, there was a lot of talk this week about Back to the Future as a trilogy, which blew my mind that people don't like the second one. That was maybe my biggest revelation this week, was people talking crap about Back to the Future 2, which I will literally get into a fist fight with somebody over.
I mean, you could agree it's the weakest of the three, though, right?
No.
Mm. Okay.
I would say more, but I'm afraid of. But then again, I don't know what I would say would be the weakest, though. Like, I love all three of them so much, and I think it's hard to judge the other two without Back to the Future 2 being the like ultimate time travel version of that story.
Here's what complicates it is, number one, the first, because it was not originally, I don't think, envisioned as a trilogy, the first one is the best complete movie, you know, similar to, you know, Star Wars was very, very good. It was meant to be just the first, a standalone movie. The third one, I think, is an adorable self-contained narrative with a beginning, a middle and end. Everything that makes sense. It's, you know, kind of this, you know, precursor to steampunk, that movement that, you know, still makes waves today. I think that the second movie is the most erratic in that it swings wildly. There's so many different set pieces, and it is kind of all over the map. The story is a bit of a hot mess. However, it also has far and away the best, most iconic moments in the entire trilogy are buried in the second one as well. Would you say that's fair?
Sure. I mean, I think it certainly, it almost has this weird TV plot. Like, it almost kind of feels like it's like, oh, well, we did the thing. Oops. Like, now we're going to go on this other weird, you know, adventure and stuff. You know, I just can't look at it objectively, but like the idea that that trilogy would feel wholly incomplete to me if we didn't have the balls to the walls. Now we're in the future. Now we're in the past. Now we're doing this recursive redo of the end of the first movie with like this meta eye view, which is something that like almost feels de rigueur now, but I feel like when I first saw it, completely broke my brain. Like,
well, and plus also, oh, go ahead.
Well, remember, 2 and 3 were shot back to back. One of the rare examples where they really did shoot, you know, one of the first examples ever of them doing a back to back part 2 and 3. And, you know, in the first one, the major story arc is certainly George McFly. He's the one that has the biggest character change. Marty does have an arc. And I just watched the behind the scenes documentary, you know, Back in Time, where, you know, the guy who gets credit for Rick and Morty but doesn't actually write it, you know, says that, you know, Marty McFly doesn't have a character arc. And it's like, no, he has an arc. There is this part of his realization is, oh my God, my parents were just like me. I need to look at my parents differently, which he does do. And that's pervasive throughout Back to the Future Part 1, is that, you know, his understanding of the world has changed at the end of that. You know, his understanding of what they came from.
And if anything, that's subtle only because Michael J. Fox as playing Marty McFly is kind of so cool and so like mature that even when he's in his like, oh, I'm a rough and tumble teenager who's on the wrong side of the tracks. It's like, you never really think he's in all that much trouble.
I mean, let's face it.
So cool.
He does the best job of playing Brett Rounceville of any actor I've ever seen.
Yes, yeah. No, definitely. But you know, the thing about 3, which what shocked me was that I had always thought that 3 was the most maligned of the two, because 3 was the movie that I had always heard criticized the most, because it's like, hey, let's have a time travel franchise that almost completely eliminates time travel, except for like two moments at the beginning and the end.
Well, and actually, that's what I loved about it, because it's like time travel, once you introduce future technology, you sort of get a free pass. You're like, of course, in the future, technology is better. That's why time travel works. But it's like, just go back 30 years and try to time travel from the 50 with a mostly complete time machine. And like, that alone was a great challenge. And it's like, oh no, wait, it gets way harder when you try.
But at least in the first movie, he's interacting with like his parents as teenagers.
Correct.
In the third movie, they have to invent like, oh no, like Biff was descended from this really like evil, outlaw. And no, Marty McFly's great grandparents are also here. And they just got here from Ireland with a terrible Irish accent.
But don't forget that ZZ Top was in the third one. And that goes along.
Great Clint Eastwood homage too.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so awesome. And that's the thing, is the third movie references for a few dollars more as much as the second movie references the first movie. Like, there are whole swaths of Back to the Future 3 that, like, aside from the one thing that you see Biff watching the movie in the hot tub in Back to the Future 2,
yeah,
like, if you have not seen For a Few Dollars More, like, it is like half of the enjoyment of the movie is lost to you with as many winks and nods.
I would say, if you wanted to criticize Back to the Future Part 2, in my criticism as a kid going in there and seeing this and walking out was, I didn't want them to leave the future. It was so interesting, so fascinating. And the story I thought was a great story. Like, what if Biff becomes the worst version of Biff? We saw him become the Dominion version of Biff. What if Biff is this pervasive guy throughout time who is going to be a problem and, you know, becomes what it is? And that was a great thing. But man, that future was so cool and awesome. That when we went away from, like, Pinocchio back. But I want to live there.
By the way, it was a news story this week. I don't know if you guys read it, but the writer of Back to the Future said, yes, no, I said it before. Let me say it again louder. Yes, we based 1980s Biff on Donald Trump. That's why he looks like Donald Trump and acts like Donald Trump and has red hair like Donald Trump.
Biff Tower like Donald Trump did in the 80s.
Exactly.
It was amazing. Yeah,
it blew my mind. People were talking mad jive about Back to the Future 2. That's crazy.
Hoverboard. It could have been just 15 minutes and there was a hoverboard, and then I'd be like,
I mean, come on. You can't criticize that movie. You need more power.
Bojo?
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.